This is an interview with Mr. formerly Commander Don Ibe of the New South Wales Mounted Police. It's taking place in the Mounted Police premises in Baptist Street in Redfern. The project is the City of Sydney's oral history project on horses in Inner Sydney. The interviewer is Margot Beasley and the date is the 31st of July 2007. Okay, Don, so you've been here a long time. You've retired now, but you started here in what year?
Started here in February of 1961.
And how did that come to be?
Well, I originally came from the Hunter Valley area up near Dungog and was reared on a beef and dairy property that my family have and my brother still has. I rode a horse to school, and when I left school I worked on the farm for a couple of years, and I thought, well, you know, we've got to find something. It wasn't enough work on the farm for all of us, so I thought I'd try the police force. On coming to the police recruiting office, which at that stage was here at Redfern, I noticed they had horses, and because I'd been riding horses since I was 4 or 5 years old, I thought, oh, I'll try that. So I ended up in the Mounted Police in March of 1961. And apart from secondments to other stations from time to time, spent all of my career here, retiring as an inspector and commander in 2005. So I had 44 years policing on horses at Redfern.
Which is quite a long time. But of course the Mounted Police predate your arrival. So, and I know you're very familiar with the history, so I wonder if you could give me a bit of a recap on how the Mounted Police came to be in New South Wales and the major twists and turns in their fortunes?
Okay, well, it's fairly extensive. I'm a bit of a historian, so I've looked into the background of Mounted Policing. And the first thing to note is that here in New South Wales, based in Sydney, we have the oldest continuous Mounted Police unit in the world. It predates the London Metropolitan Mounted Police by 3 years and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police by 38 years. So you might ask why. The answer is simple. Early policing that commenced in England with Sir Robert Peel, with the Bobbies, in the late 1700s. And any policing in England, Europe, North America in the late 1700s, early 1800s, that required horses, they would use cavalry, army horses. Governor Brisbane attempted to form a cavalry unit here. Governor Macquarie attempted to form a cavalry unit, but the Home Office wouldn't approve it. So Governor Brisbane thought a little smarter, so he formed what he called a Mounted Horse Patrol, which commenced in September of 1825, consisting of 15 men. There was 2 officers and 13 ordinary ranks that were conscripted as volunteers into this new horse patrol. So we originated as recruits from the army. In fact, at that time, there were 3 separate police forces. There was Mounted Police, Foot Police and Water Police. And it stayed that way until 1862, when all 3 groups were then amalgamated into the one New South Wales Police Force as we have today. However, predating that 1825, there was a group of horses in the city called the Governor's Guard. They weren't particularly recruited as for a policing operation, but merely as a guard for the Governor. And they were formed in 1821, again recruits from the regiment. And incidentally, their stables were where the Conservatorium of Music now is. But they were ostensibly for a Governor's Guard, not to do a general policing role. The initial role for the Mounted Police in 1825 was to patrol Parramatta Road, which was then a bush track between Sydney City and Parramatta, which was a farming community, to protect travellers against attacks from escaped convicts or renegade Aboriginals. The unit then expanded so that by 1830 there were bases set up at Maitland, Bathurst and Goulburn, or Araluen, as it was then called, which was, even today, you can look at those 3 centres and see they are the centres for corrective service buildings or jails, dating right back to those bases set up for Mounted Police. in 1862, when the three police forces were amalgamated into one, the mounted police, that were basically military personnel, had the option of either returning to the military or transferring over into the new police unit. Most of them stayed with the policing side of it from 1862 onwards. From 1862 through to the turn of the century, probably the most turbulent period of policing in the colony in New South Wales, as it was then in those earlier days, because it was the bushranger period. And over that period of time, there was 35 mounted police either killed or seriously wounded during the execution of their duties. Mounted policing had a bit of a turn then in the late 1800s, when they were required to put down demonstrations, riots by shearers on shearer strikes right out west of the Darling River. And the later part, right at the end of the 19th century, in the 1800s, they were used in Sydney to put down riots on the wharves. So, but apart from that, they were basically doing a routine policing role on horseback, because up in the 1800s, there were no motor vehicles. In fact, they reached a maximum strength in the early 1920s of nearly 1,000 horses and men.
In New South Wales.
In New South Wales. Because that was the only means of travel. Of course, since that time, with the advent of motor vehicles, there was a gradual reduction in the use of mounted police on horseback. The last mounted police officer to be decommissioned, in police terms, was at a place called Bellbrook, west of Kempsey, and that constable there, was his horse was replaced with a Land Rover in 1962. So today the only mounted police that are effectively riding horses are stationed here at Redfern, and they cover the whole state. But basically the city, CBD and suburbs, is their normal area in which they work. In fact, today there was 10 or a dozen of them gone to Bathurst to do with the car races. So we do cover still the whole state.
But out of Sydney. Yes. Whereas formerly most mounted police were probably rural, were they?
Yes. In fact, after the First World War, this property here, and a little bit of history about the stable or complex areas for mounted police, the original stables were old army barracks, known as Belmore Barracks, that were situated where Central Railway today stands. In fact, north of Eddy Avenue is a park there called Belmore Park, named after the original Mounted Police Barracks. The Mounted Police moved out of there in 1905 to allow the railway to come through from Redfern to Central, and they occupied stables at the old Sydney Showground at Paddington for about 18 months, prior to the police department acquiring this property here at Redfern in 1906. It was officially opened in 1907 as a mounted police remount station, so that all of your recruits for mounted police since 1907 would come here to Sydney for a period of 3 months. They'd have dormitories here, they'd be trained here, and at the end of their 3 months training, that police officer and his horse would go to Darling Harbour, be consigned on a railway, and whether they were transferred to Dubbo or Wagga or Bathurst or wherever, they would go out to the bush then and become a routine mounted police officer in the bush. But they were all initially trained in Sydney.
So this site here in Baptist Street in Redfern was the place where mounted police for the state were trained?
Exactly. Since 1907. Prior to that, it would have been the Belmore Barracks. Another little bit of trivia on the history of mounted policing. In the 1930s, there was a second group of late 20s, early 30s, second group of mounted police here known as the Traffic Police. Besides the normal ongoing training for mounted police to be transferred to the bush, this group of, I think there were 26 in it, their role was to patrol Parramatta Road, I think as far out as about Burwood, and the Princes Highway as far south as about Tempe, to keep horse-drawn vehicles to the left of the roadway to allow these newfangled motor vehicles keeping to the right-hand side of the roadway, so there was no confliction between horse-drawn vehicles and motorised traffic. So in fact what you had was the motorised traffic towards the centre of the road, travelling in either direction, and the horse-drawn vehicles on the curb side of the roadway. And they were in existence for about 10 or 12 years.
That particular force,
to allow for the transition of horse-drawn vehicles to motorised vehicles.
There were probably still, I guess, a number of horse-drawn vehicles even after that period.
Sure.
Appearing irregularly.
Yeah, particularly after the Second World War. There was a fast decline in horse-drawn vehicles, not only police-wise, but right through the commercial world. Because prior to the Second World War, there'd be a lot of horses in the city for business purposes. You know, a lot of the deliveries and that would have been done by horses. And I can remember when I was a kid in the bush, you would go to town and see the baker and the butcher and the milko going around town with a horse-drawn cart in the 50s.
Mm.
So, you know, there were still horse-drawn vehicles, but lesser in number.
Yes, and I suppose, in fact, the horse-drawn vehicles in the suburbs, they stayed around in some places until even the 60s, I think, in
some
places. But they wouldn't have required policing if they were just doing local routes, and so it's not as if Parramatta Road would be a very different proposition.
Yeah, sure, because you wouldn't have, particularly in suburban streets where you've got deliveries such as the baker or the milko, they're in quite suburban streets. And a horse is a creature of habit. And it's surprising how you can get a horse to adjust to traffic and just... I mean, we ride police horses now in the city on Friday, Saturday nights in lights when it's a lot of traffic, and you can get the horse conditioned to traffic. So therefore, even in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, baker's cart horses would be used to traffic because they've sort of been worked with them and there wouldn't be a problem. But initially, as you could imagine, back in the late 20s, when you got newfangled motor cars coming on the road, the horses would find them a strange sort of new vehicle, and because of the congestion of them, they needed to separate horse-drawn vehicles from motorised traffic during that transition period.
Mm. I suppose even just the motorised traffic itself was adjusting to new circumstances too. It was getting more and more dense.
Exactly. And even today, we have you have your Motor Traffic Act, which handles all motor vehicular traffic of all types. So you have laws controlling or governing motorised traffic, that's called the Motor Traffic Act, and then you have what's called the General Traffic Act that covers unmotorised vehicles such as horse-drawn vehicles and push bikes. And the laws are similar, but they do have still two different Acts of Parliament control, even local government ordinances control that, and pedestrian traffic. So they still have legal control over both motorised traffic as against non-motorised, going back from those days.
Now, as far as the history of the Mounted Police is concerned, you know, primarily to do with this site, we can talk a little bit later about what your specific duties, the Mounted Police's duties are today. I'm wondering, though, if, say, in the early part of the 20th century, say the first half or so, if there were switches and changes in what the Mounted Police did. You talked about late 19th century putting down riots and strikes. You talked about special traffic duties. Were there other things that the Mounted Police might have done then that particularly come to mind?
Well, another major one was in the mid-1920s. There were major coal miner strikes up at Rothbury, which is between Maitland and Singleton, where the Mounted Police actually set up stables up there, and there was a couple of deaths up there as a result of these demonstrations or riots. That was another one that comes to mind of a major incident. But most of the Mounted Police work was generally normal, general-duty policing, only on horseback.
But you mean by that just routine patrolling?
Routine patrolling.
Like policemen on the beat,
exactly.
But they're not on foot there.
Or pre-motorised days, if you were out in the bush somewhere, or even in the outer suburbs, then you had to go and inquire into some incident you didn't have a motor car, you had a horse. And that's why there were nearly 1,000 of them in the state in the early 1920s, because horse-drawn vehicles were the main means of transport by your police. Mm. So it was a lot of general police work, but in addition, there would be times of strife, riots, demonstrations, where they would be used as well. And the Rossbury coal miner strikes is one that comes to mind. Mm. Incidentally, you talk about the history of this place here where we are, Redford,
Baptist Street.
At Baptist Street, itself has a history. It originally, in the latter part of the 1700s, early 1800s, was known as the Sir John Baptist Gardens, hence the name Baptist Street, out the front of the stables. In the mid-1800s, it was purchased and stables were built on it on this site, and it was used as a horse-drawn omnibus depot. And with the advent of trams and other types of transport, horse-drawn buses, horse-drawn omnibuses went out, and that's when the police acquired it in 1905 for use as what was then called the police depot, specifically for training of mounted police to go to the bush. After the Second World War, when the mounted police numbers weren't required, as they were earlier, this then became the police training centre. Then its name changed to Police Academy. And the Police Academy went to Goulburn in the early 1980s, and it became known as the Redfern Police Complex, where there are a number of other police units beside the mounted unit attached here. Now it is the Redfern Mounted Police Stables. So it's really gone back to what it was originally. Only some of it's been sold off to the Taoist Association. But the stables are still here as they were originally when purchased in 1905.
Okay, so let's talk about the second half of the 20th century. You're saying that really after World War II, when vehicular traffic, motorised traffic, just grew and grew, and horses as a mode of transport went into a decline, what happened to the mounted police then? Did they begin to be perceived as a bit old-fashioned or anachronistic in some way?
There was a time in the early 1950s when the police department, I suppose the government, would have said, you know, horses are old hat, they're finished, we're in the motorised era. And there was a time when there was consideration to sell off the horses and convert these stables for use of motorbikes.
And in fact, police motorbikes.
Police motorbikes. The idea was at that time, if they auctioned all the horses and saddles off and pulled out the stables, they could put extra doorways to house police motorcycles. Before that came into fruition, they had to rethink about it and thought they'd keep them on, which they did. And they then inherited the role of the official escort, mounted escorts for VIPs, which was previously done by the Light Horse, the Army. So after the Second World War, the Light Horse was phased out as such, and they went into the cavalry, went into tanks and armoured personnel carriers. So there were no military horses. So the mounted police inherited that role.
That ceremonial.
Ceremonial role. Escorts for VIP, you know, Governor General, Governors, Majesty, if she's here, any other VIPs. So that was enough to sort of say we better keep the police horses. But then we inherited a role in the city of pedestrian control during the 50s. In the 1950s, with the growing number of people in the city, there were no traffic lights. There were foot police stationed at Clarence Street, which is then the traffic station, and their job was to supply constables to work on the major intersections in Sydney City, from Sydney Town Hall north on George, Pitt, Castlereagh and Elizabeth Street, particularly on Park and Market and King and further down, and also Railway Square, to work on those points at peak hours, morning, afternoon and lunchtime.
Well, Railway Square would have been a bit of a nightmare, I suppose. Before
Railway Square was a big nightmare. And bearing in mind, at that stage, there were still trams, too. So we inherited the role of traffic duty. And I can remember when I joined the police in 1961 at the finish of training, in the mornings we would have mounted police in Railway Square and Eddy Avenue controlling pedestrians. The main purpose was pedestrian control. Although we did work a lot of the major intersections along Anzac Parade, at Cleveland Street, down at Allison Road, Redfern Bridge, some of the major intersections, we at that stage had wide roads, six lanes wide. A mounted constable sitting in the middle had elevation, so he could be easily seen. So we worked a lot of traffic duty. So you do traffic duty in the mornings at Eddy Avenue and other areas, and then at lunchtime there'd be at least a dozen of us, sometimes up to 16, would ride into the city, and our role from 12:30 p.m. till 2 p.m. was to work on the major intersections on the corners of the street. There would be a foot constable in the middle of the street controlling the vehicular traffic, and we would control the pedestrians to make sure they didn't try and cross the road when the traffic was moving in that street. For instance, if the traffic was moving north and south in George Street, we would be standing in George Street making sure they wouldn't cross the road at Town Hall or opposite Queen Victoria traffic, or Queen Victoria building, while the traffic's running in George Street. You could then let them walk across Park Street or George Street. But when the constable in the middle of the road would alter the flow of traffic, we'd ride the horse around the corner to stop the traffic, to stop the pedestrians in Park Street and George Street, so the traffic could flow there. And we'd do that every day from 12:30 till 2 o'clock.
So you were coordinated a bit like a set of traffic lights.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. And we carried out that operation from the 1950s right through till the late 1960s, early 70s, when the traffic lights were installed. We were virtually traffic police on horseback. Mm. Together with having a ceremonial role, or protocol role, to offer escorts for VIPs, but we did a lot of ceremonial role. In those days, Sydney used to have a big festival called the Waratah Festival. Big parade. Anzac Day marches, and we still do those sort of things. You have a ceremonial role. Where in European countries, particularly in England, they might use the household cavalry ceremonially, we use the mounted police. And still today, we have a two-pronged purpose. There's a ceremonial role and an operational role.
Perhaps now is the place to talk about the different roles that you have. I think operational is the major...
Yes.
Part of your charter, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes, it's a charter that we have that sets out what we're to do, the proportions of work, different types of work. So 80% of our work is operational, 20% is ceremonial or protocol type duties. To break that down, we've got to prioritise them. And we have four main priorities. Your top priority is public order. You know, demonstrations, riots, etc. Whatever else we might have rostered, if that happens, you just stop everything else to look after that aspect. That's your top priority. The second one is protocol. In other words, if you've got a governor or governor general or the queen or somebody of that nature out here to open parliament or open Sydney show or some other major event, we are to provide a mounted escort, if requested. So that's your second priority. Your third priority is the most time-consuming, and that is routine mounted patrols or beats. And we respond to requests from local area commanders. And most of them are in the city area, but not extensively. Can be from the suburbs, it can be from country centres. As we mentioned earlier, there's some up at Bathurst for the... So they've obviously had a request, either from police headquarters or from Bathurst. We need assistance, not only of horses, they'll probably get other branches of specialist units like police dogs and rescue and whatever.
What's happening in Bathurst?
Car races, the annual car races. Mm. So another one that comes to mind is Country Music Festival at Tamworth. Every year we send a couple or four horses up there for a week because the local area commander at Tamworth says, I need more police resources. And we find that horses are particularly good in crowd control because of their size and the elevation of the rider. means they can see more and people seem to respect the horses more. So that's your, getting back to our charter, that's your third level, the routine mounted patrols. The fourth level is public relations. So if you don't have any of those other priorities, we might be, you know, going talking to senior citizens groups, or we might do a small parade somewhere. That's a public relations exercise. So the charter is set up in those four categories, being, you know, the top priority being your crowd control demonstrations, the second one being your protocol, third one routine patrols, and the fourth one is public relations. But that's further broken up from 80% operational and 20% ceremonial, that at least 50% of your duties will be in the Sydney CBD. The other 50% will be in suburbs or bush. So it gives us some sort of guide in which we roster our people to work.
Now, the Mounted Police, I think, generally speaking, are very fondly regarded by the general public. So, in effect, even when you're doing routine policing, there's a kind of a PR role happening incidentally with
yes.
that. But in really practical terms, there are certain things that Mounted Police can do that ordinary foot police can't do, or even policing cars can't do, aren't there? There are really strong reasons, rather than just sentimentality, really strong reasons for keeping a Mounted Police force going.
Sure.
So could you tell us a bit about that? What kinds of things that can Mounted Police do that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do?
Well, your police force, besides having your police at the coalface in the stations carrying out general duty policing, the police force has a lot of specialist units to support the police at coalface in certain situations, and demonstration's a good one. There's a lot of specialised areas in the police. You've got your plainclothes group, you've got the highway patrol, they're the bigger ones. But then you've got smaller ones, such as you've got rescue squads and the air wing and the water police, mounted police, the police dog squad. So there's a number of what we call support units, and they're there to help in certain situations. So they're a support unit. So you look at what can we do with a horse that might assist the general duty police in certain circumstances. So because a horse is quite a large animal, and I had the privilege, I suppose you'd say, to go to London in 1997 to study the London Metropolitan Mounted Police. And they have nearly 200 horses in London, the police horses in the Metropolitan Police, to study their procedures and training methods so that we might update if we were behind the eight ball before Sydney Olympics. And when we were in London, the inspector over there said the statistics they found was that one rider on a horse is equivalent to 10 or 12 on foot in crowd control. So there's a fairly valuable stat that if you've got 10 police horses, that's equivalent to 100, 120 police on foot in crowd control. It also has another benefit. Because the horse is a large animal, and also the inspector told me that we human beings have an inbuilt psyche, an inbuilt feeling towards horses and dogs. We don't like to see horses or dogs mistreated. So therefore, even in a crowd control situation, you generally find that your horses are unlikely to get injured or hurt by demonstrators. You might get the odd radical, but from my experience over the years I was in the Mounted Police, you know, and as the guy in London said to me, even in severe riots, their attitude may be you can kill a cop, but don't hurt the horse. So the horse has a psychological advantage in crowd control, besides the fact that it's equal to 10 or 12 foot police in a crowd control situation. For example, in the Olympic Games at Barcelona, and I looked at the stats at all of the recent Olympics before Sydney Games to see what role horses were used in Atlanta and other centres before, and in Barcelona they used them as what they call crowd pacifiers. So at the end of a day at the Games, when there was a mass exodus from the arena, they would release a couple of mounted police every 100, 150 metres in the crowd. They just walk with them. It had a dual effect. All the crowd could see the officer sitting on the horse, so it gave them a sense of security. Any would-be bag snatchers or hoodlums would also see them and refrain from snatching a bag, so it had a dual purpose. The mere presence of a police officer sitting on a horse, it can be easily seen, seemed to pacify crowds. I know from my experience when I was in the police, I used to get phone calls from residents around inner suburban areas when we would be riding 6 or 8 horses into Sydney CBD, because we used to, well, we still do, work in the Rocks area and King's Cross and around Darlinghurst, Darling Harbour, all those areas. We'd ride into the city and you'd get a phone call from local residents saying, you know, we haven't heard the horses riding down Kippack Street the last few weeks or the last week or so. Why? And we say, well, look, they ride all different routes. They don't go the same route. And they will say, oh, you know, we haven't heard them in our street. It's comforting at 11 o'clock at night to hear clip-clop, clip-clop, and we know the police are out there. So it has that effect as well. So there's a number of reasons where horses can assist your general duty police. We don't take over their role, we only help support.
There's some pretty clever things you can do with horses too, I think, in certain kinds of situations. If you're, for instance, having trouble down at the Rocks on New Year's Eve, or you want to separate particular people out from the general Malayan crowd, you can actually use two horses, can't you, to remove somebody from a crowd?
Well, we always operate in pairs. We never send out lone horse patrols. And that's a safety thing. It's an health and safety thing for the riders as well as horses as well as general public. But, of course, a horse is a creature that you need to train to do whatever you want it to do. I mean, if you've got a racehorse to race at Randwick, you train it to be a racehorse. You can train it to be a show jump. You can train it to be a dressage horse. And in the old days, we mentioned earlier, the Milko and the Baker, he had a horse-drawn cart. And he didn't get up on his cart each house he went to and drive the horse, you know, 10 metres and get off it. The horse knew, as being a creature habit, every day he stopped at the first house and the second and the third and the fifth and the sixth and the ninth, whatever, and the horse would automatically walk there because he practiced it every day. So you can train a horse to do a variation of things, and there's no exception for police horses. So you need to train your horse to do normal routine patrols, and when they first come to Redfern, they just do quiet patrol work around the back streets here. And then you watch their training progress and their temperament, and you gradually introduce them to a bit more traffic on a busier street. With an old quiet horse, never alone, always in pairs. And you put the young horse on the left-hand side and the quiet horse on the right-hand side, so that the quiet horse tends to shield the young horse until it's trained, until it relaxes to know that that's its job. And then as this training progresses, you would take it into the city, and then later on into the city at night time, which is a whole different aspect, riding with lights. And the last thing you do is put it into a demonstration or crowd control situation, and again, where you might have 8, 10, 16 horses, you'd only put one or two younger ones in there. So it's a learning process over time. But on routine patrols, yes, there's certain procedures that you train, the same as foot police train in crowd control. There's certain techniques, procedures, drill movements, we call them, that you can perform in a situation. And the riders and horses rehearse that. So when the real thing comes up, they can sure, because on a horse, again, the rider is elevated, and if there's a bit of a brawl, say, down at the Rocks or outside a club or a pub, and there might be 10, 20, 30 people involved, the rider of the horse can actually see in there and go in and help extricate offenders, and that assists.
So how do they do that? How would they go in? Don't you sometimes use horses in pairs?
Always
to,
in pairs.
No, but I mean to extricate an offender.
Sure, you do.
The offenders, some very clever move that you told me about.
It's a very clever move where you just go in, and if where you locate the offender, the rider only needs one hand to control the horse's reins. The other hand controls the shoulders of the offender between the two horses. So the offender is shielded from the crowd, and you simply walk the horses through the crowd back to an area where there may be a police truck or something if the offender is being apprehended or arrested. But generally you find that once you arrive in that situation, there are generally police support there besides horses, and you only have to extricate one or two people and you find that it's all over, generally.
Now, what about training? There's obviously so much invested in the horses, so much time, facilities and mental energy to keep horses up to, I suppose, their maximum performance levels, so that they can do the job that they need to do. So what kinds of things would happen here on a daily basis here at Baptist Street too? I think you probably exercise them, do you?
Horses have to be exercised. We can't leave them locked in a stable, enclosed stable, without exercise. Sure, and there are a certain number of grooms here, horse attendants, that clean out the stables and put them on the horse exerciser, which is a large exercise machine, and make up horse feeds and clean out horse floats, and all of those in-house procedures are done by public servant horse grooms. That allows police time to go out and do their police work. And we have eight of those employed.
Eight grooms?
Eight grooms. And there's a total, I think, the authorised strength is 36 police. So you've got 36 police and eight grooms. So the grooms do the in-house maintenance of the horse and equipment, generally, which allows police more time out on the road. So that's roughly... A lot of the in-house stuff is done by the grooms, but most of your patrol work is done on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, weekends. A lot of your ceremonial or protocol work is generally at weekends. So Monday, Tuesday is probably one of your major rest days because it's there's less activity. And Wednesday is a training day, generally. But not always. I mean, in this case, we've sent them to Bathurst today, Tuesday, so tomorrow won't be a training day. But they would normally get at least three training days a month. And it's important, a horse being a creature of habit, that you need to have ongoing training. It's not a matter of training the horse up to the level of doing night patrols in the rocks on New Year's Eve through the city or doing a demonstration, as a human being would go to primary school, high school, university, receive an education and go out into practice somewhere, and that's the end of it. A horse needs ongoing training, otherwise it forgets over a period of time. So you need these ongoing training days. And if you know there's a major event, such as a demonstration or New Year's Eve, we in fact will practice with a mock crowd these manoeuvres, the drill movements that we do, even immediately before we go down. In other words, we refresh the horse's memory of about what we're about to do. So that ongoing training is a very necessary part. And it's usually every Wednesday, would be at least three days a month.
Would the training, or has the training of horses changed much in your time with the Mounted Police, or do you know if it changed much in the preceding era? Did it get more sophisticated?
It has got more sophisticated in recent years. It wouldn't have changed much from the 1800s through the early part of the 1900s. A little change in our history, and I did mention earlier that during the 1960s, I was doing a lot of traffic duty on horseback, pedestrian control and traffic duty. When the traffic lights came into being through the city, we were then doing traffic duty on the outskirts and inner suburbs. And as the traffic lights gradually took over all the intersections, our role changed. We were told we were then a public relations branch. So in the 1970s, we travelled all over the state doing riding exhibitions in such things as musical rides, which is really only a series of mounted drill movements done at the walk, trot, canter, gallop, with 16 or 20 horses, with appropriate music provided by the police band. It's an exhibition, but it's also a game, a training exercise for better control of horse rider in any situation. I mean, if you can control a horse at a gallop doing drill movements on the showground, you've got a pretty good horse and a pretty good rider when it comes to crowd control. But during the 70s, we went not many towns in New South Wales we didn't go to, the bigger towns, doing musical rides, tent pegging displays, gymnastic displays. So in the during the 1970s, we were a PR branch. During the 1980s, of course, change of flavour, change of policing, costing and all of that sort of thing, that role gradually diminished, so we took on, looking at overseas units, we took on what we call an operational role. Started doing patrols in Centennial Park, Moore Park, Queen's Park, Hyde Park in the city. And it was in the early 1980s we started doing patrols in the Rocks area in the afternoons, on Thursday, Friday, Saturday afternoons. In fact, there were some horse drinking troughs that Sydney City Council either installed or refurbished down in the Rocks area, so that when the police horses were doing their patrols in the summertime in the afternoon, they could have a drink of water. However, we didn't use them because, unfortunately, some of the younger generation that might have been at the clubs or pubs the night before would put all sorts of garbage and rubbish in the water trough. So we didn't use them, unfortunately.
What do you do for water for your horses when you're out?
Well, a horse can go without water probably longer than a human being. So if the rider goes without a drink for 3 hours on a patrol, for the sake of the horse. But when the rider comes in for a meal break during their patrol, they will get a drink, water, whatever, so the horses are watered. Even if it's a lengthy period of commitment, again, New Year's Eve, we'll have horses in the city probably in the vicinity of 6-7 hours, maybe more, from 8 p.m. at night time to probably 3 a.m. in the morning. But then we set up a base, a mobile base, which for New Year's Eve is in the Government House grounds. They've got quarters there for gardeners and employees. So we set up a base there with a couple of horse floats, and all of the mounted police, and there's usually 20 of them in the city, will rotate on a relief and come in for the rider, will have a relief, and the horse will get a drink of water and a biscuit of hay, and out they go, and there'll be a rotation of them coming in for breaks. So we'll set up a base for the horse float to make sure that after a period of 3 or 4 hours they can get a bit of relief. But the horse can go pretty well all day without water.
Have you ever been involved in any sort of major events? You talked about the Olympics. What about demonstrations in the 60s, 70s?
Yes, we in the 1960s, a few things come to mind. It was the Vietnam War, and there were a lot of moratoriums in the city. And one thing comes to mind was President Johnson came here from the US, and we were actually giving him a protocol escort. As I mentioned earlier, that's the protocol mounted escorts for VIPs, protocol escort down Oxford Street. And it got a bit turbulent, and the motorcade took off at high speed with motorcycle escorts. We were relieved of our ceremonial lances and told to go down to the Mitchell Library area and then around into the Domain, where President Johnson's car was, and we were there expressly for the purpose to keep the crowd away from the motorcade and the entrance to the library where he was, the art gallery where he was going to. And we assisted a lot of the foot duty police then with our apprehending people, putting them in the back of police trucks. That's one that come to mind. Another one, we had the President of South Vietnam at that stage.
Was
that Air
Vice Marshal
Key? That's it, yeah. So we did an escort for him. So that was another one that came to mind, where we did both ceremonial and operational or crowd control using the horses in the 60s.
Now, the horses are very well trained in crowd situations. What about the human police? Are there ever times when they get into difficulty, or where, you know, what's it like being in the midst of a big Malay on a horse?
Pretty daunting. It's pretty daunting, which is why we need to continually rehearse these drill movements, so that both the horse and rider know when they come into a stressful situation like that, they will automatically kick into the training they've done. I mean, if you only teach them once and 2 years go by and it's not rehearsed, then maybe panic will set in, or what do we do next? But if these drill movements are rehearsed with both horse and rider, that kicks in. So whoever the commander of that group will just give directions to them. Do A, B, C, D, and you just do it through habit. But there are always instances, and we had one instance I recall not that long before I retired. They had a major incident in the city where we're using the horses as a demonstration, and there were a group of foot police that needed relief from a vehicular entrance to a building in the city, and we put the horses in to relieve the pressure on the foot police, and one guy threw some marbles under a horse, causing the horse to fall, and both the horse and rider receiving minor injuries. Nothing serious. As an example of what I said earlier about, you know, horses and dogs being an animal that people tend to want not to see hurt, the next day when I was in the office, I received dozens of phone calls from concerned citizens who had seen the TV news the night before and saw this horse fall, and they would ring up and the conversation would go something like, I was watching the news last night on the ABC and I saw one of your horses and riders had a fall in that terrible demonstration in the city, and I'm just ringing up to see how the horse is. Oh, by the way, how's the rider? So you see, that's an indication there is concern for the condition of horses. So there are some of those type of things that do cause you some concern. But having said that, beside training the horse in certain manoeuvres, certain drill movements to cater for some of these demonstrations, we do put protective wearing apparel on the rider and the horse to protect them against, you know, there might be some demonstrators that have wooden sticks and placards, and they might be throwing missiles or whatever. So the horse has a protective headgear on it. The reins on the bridle to the rider is a steel cable, so they can't be cut. The girth on the saddle has protective covers over it. The rider has a full face helmet. He has leather jacket to protect his body. He has long leather boots with knee protectors to protect the rider. So we do give both rider and horse some sort of protection from any missiles as well.
Now, what about the psychology of riders to horse? I think, well, you're saying that human beings have a soft spot for horses in general. And I'm wondering how that works out on the job. Do particular riders own particular horses? Are they their particular horse, or are they shared around? And what's, you know, do you have to match them psychologically, a rider with a horse? How does that all work out?
Well, firstly, the horses are not the property of the individual constable. They're purchased by the police department, so they're a police horse. And that can become a little bit of a problem if you assign a constable to the horse and there's a certain bonding takes place, certain ownership. So on occasions I've had a constable come to me and say, I'm going on leave, boss. When I go away, make sure so-and-so and so-and-so doesn't ride my horse. So you have to remind me, it's not your horse, it's a police horse. I can hear what you're saying and we'll make sure we put the right rider on. Yes, you have to look at the temperament of a horse and the ability of the rider. Generally, you've got three groups of riders and three groups of horses in the stable, in the police stable. From the horse perspective, you've got probably 20% or less that are young horses under training or only part trained. Then you've got another 20% at the other end of the spectrum that are almost bomb-proof. You know, they've been with us for probably 10 years or more. And so they're the best horses. And in the middle, you've got your trained horses that pretty well do everything. So with your riders, you've got the same sort of division. You've got... You've got your new riders. There might be half a dozen or so under training or just finished training. Then at the other end, you've got half a dozen or eight of your top riders. And in the middle, you've got your average rider. So what you do is you put your best riders on the new horses to train them. And when your new riders come, you put them on the old horses to help teach them. But then you generally match rider personality to horse. In other words, you've got a horse that's a little bit nervy, put a quiet rider on, give the horse confidence. If you've got a horse that's a little bit of a slug, a bit lazy, put a strong rider with a riding crop to probably get the best out of it. So what you're after here is not the best individual horse-rider combination. What you're after is the best combined team effort with all of your troop, so that when you're doing a major event in a crowd control situation, or you're doing an event like a ceremonial parade for Anzac Day, or doing an escort for the Governor to open Parliament, that you've got the best team effort from what you've put together.
So as a commander, you have to think, unlike other people who are in charge of organisations who just have to worry about the psychology between people, you have to worry about the psychology between, particularly when people are riding in pairs, the two people in the pair, and then, so it's person to person, person to horse, and also, I suppose, horse to horse.
Yes, correct. It always, because sometimes you get a couple of horses that don't get on too well. They either want to kick each other or bite each other. You say, you know, we don't put major and trooper together. Well, if you're putting them on a horse float, don't forget that, you know, Darcy or some other horse doesn't travel well in that position. So you do have to look at horse psychology. In fact, you probably look at that first. When you're looking at a job coming up, you say, what available horses do we have that can handle this job? Then put the riders on them.
Now, I know people will want to know, and I want to know myself, really, what kinds of horses do you use for policing? Where do they come from, and how do you choose them?
Okay, well, we've got some horses recently because we're coming up to APEC, but generally in the past, you don't look for a particular breed. And we often get asked, what breed of horse do police use? And we don't care, as long as it has four very important traits. And they are that it is 16 hands high, or above, or more, that it is bay or brown, bordering on the dark brown-black in colour. Now, those two traits you can see on inspection. You can see and measure how tall it is, and you can see its colour. The other two traits, however, require a trial period, and that is to see if they're physically sound. They've got no veterinary ailments. And lastly, to see that their temperament or their mental approach is suitable for police work. So in essence, we're looking for 16 hands or above.
Height. Height is very important. Obviously.
Height's very important. We don't have small horses. And a hand, by the way, is the old English method to measure a horse. And it's 4 inches on the palm of the hand, which is 100 mil, on the palm of the hand from the bottom of the little finger, top of the thumb.
So it's a sideways measurement.
It's a sideways measurement. From the bottom of the palm to the top of the thumb, and it's 4 inches or 100 mil in modern measurement. So 3 hands would make 1 foot, which is 300 mil. So it's an old English measure. So when you hear about measuring a horse in so many hands, that's how it was done. So our horses have to be 16 hands or above, which is 5 foot 4 inches high. And they need to be of a heavy bone.
That means to the height. Where is that
height of the front shoulder, above the front legs.
Okay.
Not their ears, because you can't measure the tip of their ears, because if they're standing looking at something, they're much higher than when they're having a drink of water. Mm. So you're looking for height, you're looking for colour, you're looking for soundness or veterinary. So they've got to be sound, no veterinary problems, and most important, they've got to have a good, quiet temperament. Now, if they've got those four things, It's only a matter of training. And we don't care if they're thoroughbred horses or stock horses or thoroughbred stock horse cross or thoroughbred warm blood cross. Doesn't matter. Well, as long as they've got those four traits.
So where do you get them from when you have to buy some new horses?
Some are purchased, some are donated. Some of them are ex-race horses that we might get off the track and we'll trial them for a period to see if they're suitable. A lot of them are not because they're too highly strung, too nervous. Some of them are purchased and the stock horse thoroughbred crossed, like stock horses. So it depends on whether it's donated or purchased, how long you keep it for. Sometimes if it's donated, then the owner might say, we'll give you the horse, but when you finish with it, we'd like it back. That might be a condition that we receive the horse. But the life of a horse depends on what age you get it. But generally the life of a horse is about one third that of a human being. So in essence, you know, a 20-year-old horse is equivalent to a 60-year-old human. So if we acquire a horse at 3, 4, 5 years of age, generally under 8, you can safely say you're going to get 10 to 15 years work from that horse, depending on what age you get it. And we've found over the years that thoroughbreds generally retired earlier. They don't seem to stand up to the work with age as well as the stock horse cross. So it's a matter that they are then kept not to a retirement age of, say, 20 years. We will keep them on while ever they're fit. Some might be retired 18. My old horse that I retired, just before I retired, in fact was 28 years old before we retired him. And he was pretty well bomb-proof. I mean, you could put him in a lift and take him into a building. Because horses with experience, the more you utilise the horse in a job, the more it gets to know it.
What was his name, that horse?
Richie, number one. Police horse number one. In fact, we had a little bit of a problem retiring him because he became institutionalised. We got him in 1975 as a three-year-old. So he was foaled in 1972. Came to us in 1975. And he left us in 2001. Right? So he's had 25, 26 years of policing. Now, that's been his life. So when we take him away from the stable environment for a spell, and we do spell our horses at least once a year, sometimes twice, spelling a horse means giving it a holiday, he would fret. Turn him out in a paddock, he'd fret, because to him this was home. Mm. You know, being fed three times a day, doing whatever we required him to do. So when it came time to retire the horse, it became a problem, because to him this was home. So it was only a matter of giving him short duration spells more regularly to gradually break that cycle. And fortunately, and I approached my commander then at the inner metro area and said, when I retire that horse, I want permission to retire to my custody, which he gave. So the horse ended up at my brother's property in the Hunter Valley, and he just retired gracefully up there, grazing away, but he did pass away last year.
Well, he must have been pretty old by then.
He was. 1972 to 2006, he's 34 years old.
Hmm. Have there been some particularly well-known horses? You did mention to me before one that was one up around King's Cross, I think.
Yes, it was called Star. Yeah, we've had accidents with horses. Not a lot, and when you consider the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of hours that we spend on Sydney streets, suburban streets and in the bush, really in my 40-odd years in the police, I suppose I've seen no more than 6 or 7 horses that we've had to put down or retire due to some accident or injury. Your Star had a very simple accident where he was in the back streets of the cross and they were trotting to a job because mounted police on patrol carry two-way radios, so they're in contact with the police radio network. So if they get called to a job they can go to it the same as a car can, or indeed foot police on the beat. And they were trotting in the street and he slipped on the bitumen in a cul-de-sac and got his foot stuck in a drain under the edge of the curb. And when he tried to pull his foot out, he snapped his leg and broke his leg. So he had to be put out immediately. And in fact, there's a little plaque there today just noting that area where the police horse died. So we've had a few that's died on duty. We've had a few notable horses here as well. We've had a former Melbourne Cup winner here.
Oh, who was that?
A horse called Arwan, which is actually Nowra spelled backwards. The horse was owned by the Doon brothers that lived down in the south coast and Tiamat. And they raced the horse. When it retired after winning the Melbourne Cup, we had it here for quite a number of years, but as is the case with some horses, the consistent work on the bitumen, hard roads, does tend, and in this case did tend to flare up an old shoulder injury. So he started to go continually lame after two or three years we had him working on the street. So we had to retire him. And again, because he was a donation, he's retired back to the Doon family.
And what are some of the other famous ones? Well-known ones.
We had a well-known Blue Victory. It was one that George Moore used to ride when I first came in here. He was a well-known racehorse, well, at that stage. Implosion was another well-known racehorse. The one that my predecessor, the boss, used to ride was Dusky Land, was a well-known racehorse. So I've had a number of them over the years.
And what about, are there other horses that people in the general public might have known about, apart from racehorses? Were there any held in particular affection?
Probably Monarch is, well, actually I've seen three Monarchs. Monarch is a horse that public would recall more than any other individual horse because he's a part Clydesdale. He's a drum horse and we used to do gymnastics on him. And when we do musical rides or major events, the rider actually has a set of side drums set up on either side of the front of the saddle and plays the drums, as they do probably in European countries in England. So he's a drum horse. So people would, particularly if they've been to Sydney Show and seen musical rides, they would see the drum horse with the band. And the current drum horse, and we've had a number of them, I said they were called Monarch, but the current drum horse, he's been with us now for 5 or 6 years. So he'd be well known, or as well known, as any other horse. And his name is actually Jackson, but goes by the name of Jacko. And he knows his name. I mean, I've seen riders riding around the training menage, just exercising, riding one horse, leading a horse. And on one occasion, they're leading Jacko around the yard at a trot. And if you go to the edge of the yard and call out his name, he'll stop and look for him because he knows his name. And he has a bit of a personality as well.
What kind of personality?
It's a bit of a, well, he's sort of a friendly personality, but you've got to be a bit careful and let him know he's the boss. Because if you take him too lightly, he'll take shortcuts. For example, I recall one year at Sydney Show, we're doing a musical ride, and we had a relief rider playing the drums. And I said to the rider, just watch Jacko. Towards the end of the ride, when they play William Tell Overture for the charge, he might want to go for a canter. And the rider said, don't worry, boss, it'll be right. So I'm sitting up watching the ride on a horse, Richie, in fact, blowing the whistle that controls the different movements. And when the William Tell Overture started up with the police band, because the rider is on the drum horse, is using his or her hands to play the drums, the only way you can control the horse is two Venetian blind type cords from the stirrup iron to the bit. And you just pull, if you want to go to the left, you pull the left leg back, and that sort of steers the horse. But apart from that, you don't have a lot of control. And Jacko, being a creature of habit, he just stands there. When he hears William Tell Overture, he knows there's a canter, a bit of a gallop on, he could just grab the bit, in horse terms, grab the bit and take off. Hence my caution, watch Jacko with William Tell Overture. I was concentrating on the ride, blew the whistle, next thing I heard the crowd of whatever, 20,000, 30,000, go, oh, looked over my right shoulder, and here comes Jacko, with a very embarrassed constable sitting on top of it. Jacko come to where I was. When he said, I said, just stand still. Just stand still, don't play. Pick up the reins, stand still. And he was happy to stand there with me. And then we went up, finished a little bit with the band that we do. And I said, see, he's a creature of habit. He's smart. All you need to do is stop playing the drums, pick up the rein and say, nah, stand up. And he's right. But you don't do that. And he'll just take over. That's his personality.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It's understanding horses' personalities.
What about the horses that you've got at the moment? How many have you got, and what are some of their names?
Well, again, this is probably should be talking to the current commander.
Oh, right, okay.
And I've been talking during this interview in present tense. I should be saying that. The Mounted Police today do this and do that. Mm-hmm. It's not we, it's them now, because yes. I'm now Mr., not Inspector.
Yes, although you are a bit of a fixture around the place.
Well, I am a volunteer in policing, so I did come back, and particularly with the museum, looking at historical records and maintaining the museum. But I do come back when there's a major event, if they need to pick me brain or whatever, because that's what I'm called, a volunteer in policing. So I still have some connection, but not officially as a paid employee police officer. So they do have probably 10 or a dozen new horses since I retired in the last 2 years. Obviously, they've had to up their numbers ready for APEC. So there's quite a new number of new horses. But there's a lot of horses here that still retain old, what we call, police names. In fact, down in the museum is a photograph of the contingent of 26 horses that were taken from Sydney here to Canberra for the opening of the Parliament House in 1927. And you look at that photograph, and there are 26 different little photographs of the rider and horse, and it'll have Constable John Smith riding Toby, or Constable Jack Jones riding Monarch. And you see a lot of these horse names from then still appear on police horses today. So Monarch and Toby and Duke and Dandy, they're all Mounted Police horse names that have been handed over.
So there's a tradition in the
There's naming. A tradition there.
One other question I'd like to ask you just before we wind up is, when did women come into Mounted Policing?
In the early 1980s, because of the women in policing came into the police force back in the 1920s, but they had a restricted role. And even when I joined the police in 1961, there was 148 in my intake, and there were only two women of 146 fellas. But they were only special constables. They didn't do general police duties. Their main purpose was doing school lecturing type duties in uniform, or if they went into plain clothes, they'd be searching prisoners and when the people were arrested and taken to cells, so they had a restricted role. That gradually changed until they eventually became equal to all the men in the job. But then there was a move to say, well, if they can do general duties the same as the men, maybe why can't they be in the rescue squad or the Mounted Police or any other specialised area, which they weren't in initially. But it was only a matter of time, but they still had to pass the same rigorous riding assessment as the guys. And there were some that did apply that could ride a horse, but they weren't strong enough. But eventually, the first one came in the early 1980s, and then there was a gradual trickle. In fact, today, there are far more females in the Mounted Police than males.
Oh, is that right?
And you might say, why? How come?
Hmm.
Referring back to when I joined the police, of the 36-odd police that were in the Mounted Police, probably over 30 of them come from the bush, like me. They've come off properties. They rounded up cattle or sheep or whatever on horseback. And they'd come and join the police like I did. Say, oh, they've got horses, I'll join that. Today, the people on properties that come to join the police probably ride Yamahas or Suzukis. So the content of your applicant that comes in has changed. So most of the people here that's in the Mounted Police today would have come from major urban areas, Sydney or Newcastle or Wollongong. And their background's been pony club. And if you have a look at the pony clubs anywhere today, you'll find there's more girls in pony clubs than boys. So you get that content coming in here.
Mm.
And I have, as it said, you know, are the girls as good as the fellas? Some areas they might not be, some areas they're better. But on average, they've still got to undergo the same riding assessment. And I mean, there's been the argument years ago when they did away with the size limitation for police. When I joined, you had to be 5'9" high, you had to be 11.5 stone, you could be 5.5 foot high, 5'8.5 inches tall, and 11 stone if you joined the mounted. If you were shorter or lighter, you couldn't get in. Nowadays, you know, height and weight means nothing. There's no restriction. So if you say to yourself, if you've got a short girl or a short fella, they're probably more beneficial if they're a good rider, more beneficial on a horse than if they're on foot, because they're using their expertise as a rider and they're using the horse to do the job, not themselves. So that's why we've got probably more females than males today, because the content of your recruiting is coming from pony clubs.
Okay, that's a very interesting story. Thank you very much.